In other words, leave your body alone. Take just enough care of it. Exercise a little. Feed it right foods. But don't think about it too much. Keep your mind on reality. Merge your mind with reality. And you will experience reality. You will live in a world without problems. The world may appear to have problems to others, but not you. You will see things differently from a higher point of view. I had an interesting phone call this week. Someone asked me, do self-realized people dream or have visions? Now, in order to have a dream or a vision, there has to be somebody left to have it. And yet if you're self-realized, there's nobody home. There's nobody left. So it's a contradiction. As truth is, all truth is a contradiction, it's a paradox. The answer is, sages do dream sometimes, and have visions. But they're aware of the dreamer. In other words, they realize that they are not the person dreaming or having the vision. But as long as there's a body there someplace, there will be dreams and visions. Even though there's no one home, there will still once in a while be a dream or a vision. As an example, Ramana Maharshi often dreamt and had visions. Nisargadatta dreamt and had visions. And they were both self-realized. But again, the question is, who dreams? Who has the vision? There's no ego left. As long as the dreamer is separate from the I, I can only speak of my own experience. There's no difference to me in the waking state, the dreaming state, the sleeping state, or the vision state. They're all the same. I'm aware of all of them. But I am not them. I observe them. I see them happening. As a matter of fact, sometimes I don't know the difference. Sometimes I don't know whether I'm dreaming or awake or having a vision or I'm asleep. It's all the same. Because I take a step backward. And I watch myself going through all these things. So, for some reason lately, I've been dreaming about the Queen of England. She was coming to Setheim. I don't know why, about 3 nights in a row. But, I did have an interesting vision this morning at about 4 o'clock. And we'll spend the rest of the time discussing them, because I found it very interesting. As many of you know, I've had a constant vision periodically of myself going to Arunachala, the sacred mountain where Ramana Maharshi lived. And the mountain is hollow in the vision. And I go through the mountain to the center, where there's a bright light, 1,000 times more bright than the sun. But yet it's pleasing and calm. And there's no heat. And then I meet Ramana, Jesus, Ramakrishna, Mr. Gaddafi, Lao Tse, and others. And we smile at each other. We walk toward each other and melt into one light. We become one. And there's a blinding light and explosion, sort of. And then I open my eyes. I've shared that with you before. But this morning, for the first time, I had a very interesting vision, which I'll share with you again. I dreamt I was somewhere in an open field. Beautiful field. There was a lake nearby. Trees, a forest. And I was sitting under a tree in this open field. And I had on the orange garb of a renunciate. I must have been Buddhist. All of a sudden, hundreds of bodhisattvas and mahasattvas come from the forest and start walking toward me. And they all sit down in a semicircle around me in meditation. And I wondered what I was doing. Then I realized that I'd become the Buddha. And we all sat in the silence for about 3 hours. Then one of the bodhisattvas got up and asked a question. He said, "Master, what is your teaching?" It was not in English. I don't know what language he spoke. But I understood quite clearly. And without hesitation I said, "I teach self-realization of noble wisdom." And he sat down. We sat for about another 3 hours in silence. And then another bodhisattva got up and asked the question, "Master, how can you tell when one is close to self-realization? How can you tell when one's about to become self-realized? How does one tell?" And this is what I'd like to discuss today. How can we tell if we're on the path correctly? I gave 4 principles, which I really never do in a waking state. I never have a teaching. But I was giving a teaching, so I'll share it with you. I explained 4 principles where you know that you close the self-realization. Of course, we're all self-realized already. Principle number one. You have a feeling, a complete understanding, that everything you see, everything in the universe, in the world, emanates from your mind. In other words, you feel this. You do not have to think about it or try to bring it on. It comes by itself. It becomes a part of you. The realization that everything that you see, the universe, people, worms, insects, the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, your body, your mind, everything that appears is a manifestation of your mind. You have to have that feeling, that deep understanding, without trying to. So you ask yourself, what do I think about all day long? Of course, if you fear something, if you worry, if you believe something is wrong somewhere, if you think you're suffering from lack or limitation or sickness or anything, then you're out of it completely. Because you're not understanding that all these things are simply a manifestation of your own mind. And if you worry about these things, you become attached to false imagination. That's called false imagination. You've been attached to habit energy for many years. And all these attachments and these beliefs come from habit energy. It's like watching a TV show and becoming one of the characters when you know that you're not even in the TV. But you believe you're one of the characters in the TV show. So it is with the world. Do not get involved. I don't mean you become passive. I mean your body does what it's supposed to do. Remember, your body came to this earth to do something. It will do something without your knowledge. It'll take care of itself, don't worry. But do not identify your body with yourself. They're different. Your body is not yourself. And I'll prove this. When you refer to your body, what do you say? Don't you say, my body? Who is this my you're referring to? You say, my finger. My eye. Who are you referring to? You couldn't be talking about your body because you're saying it's my body. Like you own it. Who owns it? This proves to yourself that you're not your body. So do not identify yourself with the body in the world. Therefore, the first principle to see how close you are to self-realization is you are not feeling that you are identifying with the world. You're separate. And you're feeling happiness because your natural state is pure happiness. once you identify with worldly things, you spoil it. Your happiness disappears, it dissipates. But when you're separate from worldly things, happiness is automatic. Beautiful, pure happiness that comes by itself. So that's the first principle. The second principle I explained to the Bodhisattvas was this. You have to have a strong feeling, a deep realization that you are unborn. You are not born. You do not experience a life. And you do not disappear. You do not die. You are not born. You have no life. And you do not die. You have to feel this, that you are of the unborn. Do you realize what this means? There is no cause for your existence. There is no cause for your suffering. There is no cause for your problems. Some of you still believe in cause and effect. This is true in the relative world. But in the world of reality, there is no cause. Nothing has ever been made. Nothing has ever been created. There's no creation. I know it's hard to comprehend. How do I exist if I was not born? I have no life, and I do not disappear at old age. You exist as I am. You have always existed and will always exist. You exist as pure intelligence, as absolute reality. That is your true nature. You exist as Satchitananda. You exist as bliss consciousness, but you do exist. You exist as emptiness, as nirvana, but you do exist. So don't worry about being non-existent. But you do not exist as the body. You do not exist as person, place, or thing. Do you feel that? If you have a strong feeling about that, then you're close to self-realization. Principle number three. You are aware and you have a deep understanding of the egolessness of all things. That everything has no ego. I'm not only speaking of sentient beings. I'm speaking of the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, the human kingdom. Nothing has an ego. There is no ego. And do you realize what this means? It means that everything is sacred. Everything is God. Only when the ego comes does God disappear, which we call God. Everything becomes God. You have reverence for everything. When there is no ego, you have reverence for everyone and everything. So you have to be aware of the egolessness of all things. Animals have no ego, minerals have no ego, vegetables have no ego, and humans have no ego. There's no cause, so there can't be an effect. There's only divine consciousness. And everything becomes divine consciousness. So if you look at your fellow man and animals, and everything else as being egolessness, you will see them as yourself. Can't you see that? It's the ego that causes separation. When I am full of ego, I become strong within myself. I become totally separate. So the more you like yourself as a person, the bigger your ego is. You say, well, I'm not supposed to like myself. You're supposed to love yourself. But what self are we talking about? We're not talking about your body self, because that comes and goes. We're talking about your permanent self that has always been here. And your permanent self is me, is you, is the world, is the universe, is everything. That's your permanent self. Egolessness. That's the only time that you can love your fellow human beings, when you have no ego. That's how you can tell where you're at, if you're close to self-realization. That's principle number three. Principle number four is simply this. You have a deep conviction, a deep understanding, a deep feeling of what self-realization of noble wisdom really is. What is self-realization of noble wisdom to you? You can never know by trying to find out what it is, because it's absolute reality. You can only know by finding out what it is not. So you say, it is not my body, it is not my mind, it is not my organs, it is not my thoughts. It is not my world. It is not my universe. It is not the animals or the trees or the moon or the sun or the stars. It is not any of those things. When you've gone through everything and there's nothing left, that's what it is. Nothing. Emptiness. Nirvana. Ultimate oneness. Anyway, I explain these four principles to all the bodhisattvas and all the mahasattvas. And then we sat 3 hours of meditation. And they got up and walked back into the forest. And there was a flash of light. And I opened my eyes. What do you think of that? Any questions?
Was it a dream or a vision? And how do you distinguish between the two?
Well, I don't really know, to tell you the truth. I'm usually aware of what's going on. So all the time I was aware of the vision dreams taking place.
Including the sun.
unless I realized I was doing all these things. It was like I was watching everything taking place. But there was never a time when it actually became the dream or the vision.
Or felt totally covered when it,
right.
We always observed it.
I was always observing. It was like an omnipresence observer. So that's the teaching. That's how you tell when you're getting close to self-realization. So, do you remember the four principles? Glenn, why don't you repeat that for George? Because it came late.
I don't think that I remember the four.
I think they're very important to remember. Which ones do you remember?
That, the second principle is that all things are egoless.
No, that's the third one. Same
order. The order matter?
Sam, how about you? What's the first one? See how easy we forget?
Well, you said that we are not the body.
Not that everything emanates from us.
That's right. That the whole universe is a manifestation of the mind. Everything. You've got to feel that, no, it's true.
So as long as we're identified with the body or the mind, then we're not very far off.
Exactly. You're part of the world.
How did that in short sentence? The basic.
The basic one?
Yeah, the first one.
The first one is that everything, and I mean everything, the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, the human kingdom, everything your senses show you, is an emanation of the mind. You're projecting a picture, just like you project a movie picture. And everything you see right now, in this room, comes from your mind. You may say, how can we collectively see the same thing? That's because of the habit energy that we were brought up in. So collectively, we seem to be seeing the same thing, the same picture. That's number one. What's number two? Who can tell me? You remember, Glenn? We're just nothing. It's not that good.
Oh, we're not born.
That's right. But there's something in between. No, we're not born. We have no existence. In between the time we're born and we die, we really have no existence. And we do not die. There's no disappearance.
So how would you summarize it? That we are non-existent? Or that we have no beginning and no end?
Both are right. We have no cause.
So you're saying that existence implies a relative cause, and therefore
yes.
Existence only takes place in the relative world.
Yes.
We're not really a part.
Exactly.
And non-existence?
Non-existence also doesn't exist.
Because that's a
concept.
But
then,
what,
couldn't you say that
non-existence
exists?
And
then you say that everything
exists. Nothing that you can explain
exists. That's failure. Mind.
Yes.
So how can
because you're projecting the picture.
But then you have a mind.
You don't have a mind.
Well, I think he means everything on the earth plane.
In the relative world. In reality, there's no mind. That's how the picture appears. The mind projects the whole universe. So if you get rid of the mind, there's no universe. We have to kill the mind. And the whole universe is annihilated. Because it's the mind that projects the universe. and tells us all these stories. Think for a moment all the problems that you believe you have. Think of what's bothering you. You can tell me a story about for 4 hours. This is wrong and that's wrong. It's all a projection of the mind. So by getting rid of the mind, everything stops. And beauty and joy and bliss ensue. But you're covering the beauty and joy and bliss when you worry, when you fear, when you think something is wrong sometimes. So that's precept number two. What's number three? Who can tell me?
Egoless.
Right. Everything is egoless. Not only human beings, but everything. Mountains, trees, the sun. Nothing has an ego. That means it has no existence. So where did it come from? When you have a dream, where did the dream come from? Same place. From nowhere. From false imagination.
I don't understand the expression false imagination because the word imagination implies a certain falsity.
We're imagining a false world and a false ego.
That's sort of a paradoxical thing, isn't it?
Sure, it's all paradox. Because it doesn't exist. But that's how we imagine it. This is the reason I always go back to the sky is blue. Somebody takes me outside and says, look at the beautiful blue sky. And I agree with them, but I know deep inside that that's not true. There's no sky and there's no blue. It doesn't exist. Or the oasis in the desert, the water, it doesn't exist, it's a mirage. The world's the same thing. The universe only exists in a dream state. It's like a dream. Now what's the fourth precept? What's number four?
It has something to do with you or nothing.
Well, everything has to do with that. But it's actually to have an understanding and a deep realization of what self-realization of noble wisdom is.
And how is noble wisdom defined from regular wisdom?
It's not the same thing. Just more worthy.
Worthy.
It's a Buddhist expression.
That
sounds better than just regular wisdom.
And then they always say what it is. They call it as it is, rather than give a name to it.
The Eightfold Path, and they take years explaining it.
Putting the ox upon the cart. Yeah,
right.
But when you get into the highest teaching, there's nothing.
So would you go with the fourth one again?
The fourth one, the only way to know what self-realization is by knowing what it's not. And whatever is left, that's what it is.
And that's noble wisdom.
Same thing. So you say, it's not the body, it's not the mind, it's not my organs, mm-hmm. It's not my thoughts, it's not the world, it's not the sun, it's not the universe, it's not God, it's not creation. And you go on and on and on. When you get out of breath and out of words, that's it.
Is that what the expression niti niti means?
Not this, not this.
Not this.
Yeah.
It's also like nowhere. You just put the two words, nowhere. There's nowhere.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Where is where?
Is that or?
No.
All that goes away and there is nothing.
See, that's what people think. That's why I explained before. The mind will make you say that because it doesn't want to be an alien.
Well, it doesn't.
It wants to rule and control you completely.
Why does it?
Because it's its nature. That's the nature of the mind that doesn't exist.
It's almost like the survival instinct, isn't it? The ego wants to survive,
of course.
Survival instinct.
Exactly.
When you're meditating, are you totally separate from this physical world?
When who's meditating? When I'm meditating personally? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't usually meditate. I sit sometimes with my eyes closed, but they're just the rest of my eyelids.
because there's no one there, right? There's no one to meditate.
There has to be someone to meditate.
So he feels that he has no thing and nothing. So while would someone who is self-realized need to meditate? What would they meditate about?
That doesn't mean you should stop meditating. It means you should look at these four principles and compare them to where you are yourself and work on yourself so that you can apply these principles to yourself every day. Until the day comes when you don't have to talk about them any longer. You just become a total manifestation of those principles.
You work on them, but you don't make it.
Yeah, that's what I find.
You just realize. You become aware of.
You can do that with, you can do mind games with that too, with the principle and say, okay, I'm just not going to look at things and identify with them. I don't know, maybe that's the way to start.
No, you don't start like that. You start by mindfulness.
By what?
Mindfulness. By being aware of all your actions from the moment you get out of bed in the morning.
Oh, observing yourself.
Observing yourself. Like, what are the first thoughts you think about when you open your eyes? It doesn't matter. But you just watch. Don't try to change them. That's when your mind will fight you. And that's when the games begin that you're talking about. But if you make no effort to change anything, and you just watch, that'll kill it.
So self-observation and mindfulness are the same thing?
Yes.
Another thing that I, another man that I knew that kind of taught me some things that, and something that fit for me was when he talked about just watching everything about yourself,
mm-hmm.
He also talked about accepting everything. And maybe that's kind of crazy.
The same thing, yes.
Yeah.
You don't fight. You don't try to change. But I don't like to use the word accepting. Because if some horrid thought comes to you, why should you accept it? You don't accept it and you don't reject it. You just watch it.
You don't change. So it's like you, when you were having this vision or whatever, you just sat and watched.
I just watched. It wasn't good, it wasn't bad. Just observe.
Can I make a comment about this? Yeah. That leads into an unpopular area at the moment.
Okay.
Of austerities. I've been thinking about a different approach to this. It seems to me that, for example, if we sit here and we take advantage of the fat,
yes.
And because we feel this cruel error, our attention is really, that comes because of our attention to the body. We all sit here, we all participate in this. And incidentally, we can only participate in it because of the positive efforts of the West, which says that there is a reality and that there is evolution and there is growth in that realm. So, wouldn't it be better if we declined this attention to the physical? So, wouldn't it be better if we just got rid of the fan? And then we wouldn't have to think, it's hot, we'd have to cool the body. By using the fan, of course, this is only one slight example, we acknowledge the reality of the body. We acknowledge the reality of the self. Because we're very concerned, in this particular moment, right here and now, with the status of the self in the physical world. And we're emphasizing it. We are going on about it. We are developing it. Why not go the other direction? Why not turn off the fan?
Because while you're on the path, why not be comfortable? Simple as that.
Yeah. All right, okay, then I want to, why can't I have a Rolls Royce outside? It made me very comfortable.
Well, go ahead, who said you can? See, we're not saying how to live. living this in the world has nothing to do with it. You can be rich, you can be poor, you can be well, you can be sick. It has nothing to do with it at all. That's the point.
What has happened?
Because your karma, if you're supposed to karmically have a Rolls Royce, your body's going to have a Rolls Royce, whether you like it or not. But it has nothing to do with it.
My feeling also is that this comes from being really sensitive to heat, but that if we did without the fan, I would be more focused on my body than I am in comfort.
Yeah, but that's a special situation.
Well, yeah, but wouldn't but doesn't it apply?
It still remains.
Doesn't it apply to everyone? That if you're comfortable, you're not as distracted.
I'm aware of the pleasure right now. I'm aware of my attention is turned toward my body. Because every time I feel the fan, I feel the sensation.
That's good, you think.
Yeah.
Every time it goes by, that's good.
So the attention is turned toward the transient and the physical, rather than to the other.
Then you have to work on that. If the fan were off, you'd be sweating, you'd be thinking about that.
That was what I was saying. If we were uncomfortable, wouldn't we be more focused?
It could be worse, you're saying. Yeah.
I know what you mean.
But it's an important point.
You're very hedonistic.
They're two sides of the same coin.
And maybe, you know, like we're on our way to self realization. Maybe later on in our progression, we'll be able to sit and learn about the time and be comfortable. But now, while we're in the world stages,
self-actualization is Maslow. Don't talk about that.
You know, that's one thing I wanted to bring up is I have the hardest time with words. I wish that I could, you know,
that's
communicate
good.
Without words because
you can.
Like definitions. And,
I know.
And that was one thing I wanted to ask you or comment on or something. Do you have a hard time with that you're giving us a definition of
self-realization? Oh, yes, because you have to use words. Yeah. That's why many times when you get to know me better, we sit in the silence. We don't say too much. Mm. And then you get a direct teaching that sounds. From the silence, you get the highest teachings. Mm. But if we have to use words, we do the best we can. So let's play some music. A half minute in here. We can have a song. We can have first song.
We can have what?
First song. Because he doesn't like us to eat sugar.
More sugar?
New York accent. No sugar. No sugar. But he means very well. And he's helped you a lot. I think you're awesome.
Yes. Long. Can you cut this up in little pieces?
When my children were little, when I used to buy these cookies, you know, Pepperidge Farm cookies, we don't get very many of them. They're not, I guess, now I don't think of them as jeans that expensive at that time. That's compared to some of the good ones you can get in the things, and the kids would even buy the handfuls, so you'd save those other ones.
Mm.
And I did say, oh, let us have some of those. No, you don't want to use your dust.
Once in a while, this can't hurt you. I can't think of me. It's like eating human beings. Same flesh.
It's everything the same. The plant and the mineral and the animal kingdom are all the same. It's how can you differentiate?
Because in the relative world, they're not.
You don't see the relative world.
But I won't eat
meat
then.
Pardon?
I still won't eat meat.
I think that my question would be the same. If animals have consciousness, don't plants also?
A different form. In a different dimension.
So it's like after Noah, when he said not to eat anything with blood, that is that more or less the same?
Well, it stands to reason. The animals are close to man. They bleed, they have the heart, they have lungs, they have eyes, they see.
Emotions or feelings.
So they're very close to man. So how can you eat them?
about lobsters? Well, do you think they have, you know, sympathetic feelings?
I can see that, sir.
I respect that. I heard that squids were very affectionate. Since I read that, I can't eat squid. I go to a sushi bar. It's hard to imagine an affectionate squid, but...
What's the difference?
What's the difference you're attached to?
Well, get one that you're not attached to.
Pardon?
Get one that you're not attached to.
You can eat that one too.
I know.
Well, I think some people, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but I think some people figure that the higher of the consciousness, just like you're distinguishing it between animals and plants, you know, like an amoeba probably doesn't have a real personality. I'm not sure of what to speak of, so I think some people think like a cow is dumber than a dog, and a cat lower on the intelligence level. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I do think that's what some people base it on, is intelligence level.
I made chopped liver out of it. You can tell the difference.
I've heard it tastes terrible.
Why?
I've heard that it's a very, well, it's just not... I guess our palates aren't used to it, but they say supposedly when cannibals cook human beings, it's a horrible sweet smell that's not palatable to the Western senses.
That's because the junk food's away.
Too much sugar.
Cows eat grass.
And again, there are some cultures, you know, people with extreme prejudice don't consider people they are prejudiced against as human.
Yeah, that's true.
And then, of course, in India, the untouchables who are less than dogs.
But if they're untouchable, they must be inevitable, I hope. You like the thing.
If you like to sing, go ahead and sing. There are three methods we use to help us on the path so we can realize what we were talking about before. Number one is self-surrender, where we surrender completely to God or to the self. But that's hard to do for most people. It sounds easy, but it's not. It means that you have no life of your own. You surrender completely and totally everything to God. Totally. Every part of your life goes to God. Not my will, but thine. That's devotion, bhakti. Again, it sounds easy to some people, but it's not when you get into it. Because it means every decision that you have to make is left up to God. You give your mind to God, totally, completely, absolutely. And that leads you to self-realization. Number two is mindfulness, which we were talking about. Becoming the witness. Watching yourself continuously. Watching your thoughts, watching your actions. Sitting in meditation and watching what goes on in your mind. Not trying to change anything or correct anything. Just observing. Becoming the witness to your thoughts in meditation and to your actions in the waking state. And number three is the one that I advocate, self-inquiry. Asking yourself, to whom do these troubles come? To whom does this karma come? To whom does this suffering come? It comes to me? or what is me? I am me. Well then, who am I? From where did the I come from? And following the I to its source. You can use any of those three methods, the one that suits you best. But by all means, do something. Don't waste the life with trivialities. Work on yourself if you want to become free. It doesn't mean you have to give up going to the movies or going to work or anything. You give nothing up. You just become aware of what you're doing. You become a conscious being. You become conscious of your actions. You become loving, compassionate, gentle to all people. You stop watching out for number one. And most of us say, number one, I'm number one. Again, that's how you suffer, that's ego. It's hard to understand when you give up your ego how you can have a better life, but you do. Try it, you'll see. When you start thinking of yourself and you start thinking on yourself, but yourself becomes omnipresence. That means thinking of everybody else as yourself. So if any human being suffers, you suffer too. But in a way we differ from Buddhism. Not much, but a little. Because the Bodhisattva says he will not be realized until everybody else is realized. But then they have a higher Bodhisattva called the Avat. It's like the Avadhut in Hinduism, who becomes self-realized by himself. Because he understands that his self is the self of all. And that's what we accept. In other words, if you want to help your fellow man, if you want to make this world a better world in which to live, find yourself first. And everything else will take care of itself. Any questions about that?
In the second method, you mentioned about self-observing or observing your thoughts. Isn't it the same thought which splits into observer and observe, or the same ego in that action?
Only when you give it power. Only when you think you're doing it. And when you just stop and watch, there's no action taking place. There's nothing moving.
Is it watching an action?
But you're not watching, you're just observing, you're watching, but you're not. You're not. But something is, but it's not you. Only when you think, I'm watching, the problem arises.
Isn't that the voice that says, to whom is your suffering coming?
Yeah, it'd be the same.
Yes.
It'd be that
same thing, yes.
Because
I've been watching that voice. Okay, because if you feel a calm after that, or something starts to dissolve, then you start observing
that. Well, actually, what you're doing
is you're using the mind to annihilate the mind. But you're not identifying it. You don't identify it, but you're using the mind when you say, to whom does it come?
That's not the self.
It's the mind.
Still the mind.
But you're using it to get rid of the mind.
It's becoming more one-pointed,
yes.
So that it can dissolve.
Yes. Only when you think that it's you is there any karma or action.
So, in the mature phase of certain thoughts, there'll be a point in which you are There's no awareness of observing.
There's no awareness, no.
Observing, and
that's right.
Things are being observed without
exactly.
Somebody being aware of observing.
Exactly.
And that's the mature phase of yes.
Consciousness. Yes.
It's difficult to, when you first start observing that, to, you can say that to whom does this suffering come, to whom does this karma come, and sometimes you feel a sense of it dissolving or whatever, and at other times the body is real strong or something.
Well, of course, and you try something else.
Yeah, okay, give me a
suggestion. You try to ask yourself, or you watch yourself when you surrender. You can tell yourself, okay, God, take this from me. I give it all to you. And just sort of surrender to God. Give it all to God. Give it away.
And that's the thing, I don't want this, though.
The same, but that's what you have to do.
It's sort of letting go.
Like if you're having pain or something, you're saying,
give it to God. Take it, God. It's yours. I've got nothing to do with it. You have to do what you have to do depending on where you're at in consciousness. But by all means, do something. Or you can just sit down and do nothing. That helps too.
What about sleeping?
What about?
If you're feeling certain feelings and you just go, I'm just going to go lay down.
Then you have to do that. That's what you do.
That's kind of like letting go too.
In a way.
I fight that. You know, I don't want
don't fight anything. It gives you another chance to relax, and when you wake up, you can start again.
Sometimes, though, you keep it asleep too. You know, they have problems, and then you just go asleep.
Yeah, it can be an action depression.
Well, those are people who are not working on themselves. But if those of us here realize.
You're observing it in yourself that you're fighting in the sleep. This is what I really want to do, but maybe something's telling me maybe that's what you need to do. Let go and don't fight to sleep.
That's why I say don't fight anything. Just go to sleep. But when you wake up, start again where you left off.
I have felt sometimes worse when I woke up, so that's why I avoid sleep.
Well,
because
now when...
I was legitimately, I felt very, like I just couldn't. So I'm just sitting here, why don't you let yourself go to sleep? So I'll say, okay, I'll let myself go to sleep. I go to sleep and I wake up, and it takes me about an hour or two to acclimate back and to where I'm.
Now, from this moment on, how will you react when you wake up and you feel burned?
Detached from it.
Observe it. Watch it. Even if you're feeling bad, no matter how bad you're feeling.
Don't fear. I get fear. See, that's what happens. Like, well, what does this mean? See, I start questioning it. That's what happens. It's all questioning. Well, why does this happen?
I'm going to ask, to whom does it come? But observe it, watch it. Let yourself be fearful. Don't try to change it.
Watch yourself.
Just be observant of what's going on.
Another word that I heard that was a good one for me. Of course, it's happening. That I do that a lot. You know, when I was unhappy with myself because I wasn't reacting in a way that I wanted to be, that it was a really good day, then I would just say, well, of course, and I do that way, you know, because of whatever the background was behind it or whatever. And then I can just come.
So are you relating that to self-observation?
I guess so. Yeah. It's kind of like, I guess, kind of like a prison.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just watching things happen because that's what it's saying.
I would say today my mind is full of heresy.
Today, it's very difficult to let go of the idea in the Bible that I am the vine, you are the branches. That the great drama of realization is being lived out in each differently in each human being, and that living out that drama is important
in the relative world.
I can't accept that today.
Don't.
Don't buy it.
my feeling is that the divine being. Or God, you would say so. That it thrills to the individual drama, the individual adventure.
In the relative world, that's true.
I was going to ask about this. I understand same problem. I don't know if it comes to the same point, but I was wondering, isn't it self-surrender, right?
Yes.
Self-surrender, isn't it, by instance, to decide to live, of course, always within a context of devotion to God, to decide to live as one lives, with all your demons, all your ego drives, everything, and take life as it comes and accept it. Of course, knowing that consequences are coming from action and reaction will come, and accepting everything. I understand that if the devotion is strong, things will start molding little by little, going to showing a beautiful or a better. Integrated being, and maybe at the end self-realize. In other words, if there is devotion or self-surrendering to God, no matter what you do, things will take care of itself.
Exactly. That's very true. If you surrender to God, you don't have to worry about your life again.
I mean, you don't have to be compulsively observing of your
Not if you surrender to God correctly.
Even sometimes you could be acting apparently from another observer in an egotistic way, but if you keep pursuing that emotion and surrendering, things will maybe even look for observers, outside observers.
It's like when you imagine you have a pail of dirty water, scummy water. It's been standing for years and the water is very dirty. But there's a hole in the roof. And every time it rains, a drop comes in, and it starts clearing the water. Maybe after 20 years, the water will dissipate and will be clean. That's what happens to us. The more we surrender, as you say, the more pure we become. Little by little by little by little. And everything will take care of itself. If you surrender properly.
Isn't that bhakti? Isn't that what you were talking about? Different methods? That would
yes.
be more or less the same as devotion to bhakti,
yes.
as opposed to self-observation,
as
yes.
opposed
to self-improvement. Jorge mentioned acceptance, and also Dana mentioned acceptance, and Robert said earlier, don't accept, just watch, because when you accept, there's someone to accept. Just watch. Because when you accept, it's almost like you're affirming the ego again. Just watch. So acceptance is good, but you can also just watch.
Yeah, watch without judging. Watching with just some righteousness.
Maybe it's just words again. And also Arnold's comment on God and the vine, the tree, and the branches. And Robert said, well, that's just a relative world, and that's kind of like subject-object again. In the book, Ramana said, as long as you believe that you are the self and there is a God. So it's kind of like going from non-duality into duality. So if you're dealing on the level of duality, what you're saying is true. But when you go into non-duality, then there are different principles. So Arnold seems to, well, this week I'm into non-duality, this week I'm into duality. I don't know if that helps Arnold. See what I'm saying? As long as you believe that you're the self, then there is a God and those principles apply. But then if you go into non-duality, then you are God. And so the different principles, you know, if you don't use the analogy of the tree and the branches, because you are the tree and you are the branch.
Excuse me, what you meant, your last was that just like saying that God is saying there is a good time, good play going on, right?
Yeah, that's good.
No, not exactly.
You're so wise.
God is saying that because of his play, when the play is over, I am the play. It's true, but when the play is over, I will know more about myself. I will be in a different spot than I was before the play began. Because of the play and all the participants in the play. And that through the participants, through the actors, having lived in each of the actor, I will be in a different place afterwards.
Yes, but you'll have to come back again and play another role. Again and again and again.
Because you're still identified as an actor.
That's what's been Buddhism, getting off the wheel. You want to get off the wheel and turn it around, keep turning around again and again. You want to get off.
But what if God is standing and watching this and knows that his projection is a part of it, but his essence is apart from the play. But even that essence which is apart will be in some way changed and will not be on the wheel because it never was on the wheel.
But as long as you believe in duality, you're on the wheel. As long as you're approaching a God outside of yourself, you're on the wheel.
After I have a question, we're referring to the second book where we talk about surrender to God, except that the God's not outside of yourself. Mm. And that's where the devotion thing, because I feel like I'm, well, like all three of these, I think. You can say, well, you can pick one of these. You can use all three of these, correct?
Sure.
They're not in conflict.
No, they're not.
But to talk about God, and if you surrender to God, it sounds like outside yourself.
That's how it sounds.
So, how can we surrender to God? Maybe you can explain it from like, because I have a certain part of me that has this devotional part, but I also have a part that is the more of the knowledge part too, you know. And so, but I like both. I like the combination. I want the combination plate, you know. So how do I, because like listening to the music, like, oh God, beautiful, you know. Now when I hear that, I can feel it in my being. I mean, I don't think of it as some man in a beard out there or someone with a fist. I don't think of that. I do feel it in here. But in the matter of surrender, how can we do that without making separation?
Simply surrender to yourself.
But we don't at this point really know this, but we haven't realized it.
So where's the God you want to surrender to? Where does he live? It all has to do with your own mind. You talk to yourself, you surrender to yourself. You have to reconcile yourself with yourself.
But it's past the ego, it's past the mind.
You can be very humble, have love, humility, and talk to God, but realize you're talking to yourself.
I don't know what she means. It seems like surrendering is dualistic.
That's it, the way. But you can keep. You can keep it like that if you like.
It'll go away after a while, anyway.
If it doesn't, it'll still feel great. If you surrender totally, like Ramakrishna. He never wanted to become one with God. He wanted to worship Kali, which Ram was an image of God, and he did so all of his life. But in his own way, he was self-realized. In his own way. But he never yet separated God from himself.
He was asked to surrender Kali, wasn't he? But he never did.
He never did. But he was unique.
But did he go back on the wheel then, or not?
Well, he was totally free. Because he became one with Kali. He merged with Kali, which is God.
Because I have tapes at home and I like to listen to them, and then I'm going, well, is that in conflict with
before I get on a path and say, well, this is in conflict with this, but this is separation, and this is duality.
So you make it the conflict in your own mind. There is no conflict.
Just love it and enjoy it.
Exactly. There's no conflict except what you imagine. That's what's called false imagination. You imagine this conflict or this conflict. There isn't any. It's all one.
Like when I hear, oh God, beautiful, you sort of know that you are.
Oh, yeah.
What you're in yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the moment. It's just a way of describing that. Whatever that is.
So you don't have to say it.
Yeah,
and even though that's in words, there's something about it.
But you know it's you, if you know it's you, I think that's the
Robert, isn't it inquiry a tremendous surrender?
Tremendous what?
Surrendering.
Oh, yes.
Utmost surrendering in order to go through that. It's so hard.
Devotion turns into self inquiry. Pure devotion.
Or even when you work to self inquiry intensely, you are really surrendering your ego.
You are, yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're all the same.
It feels devotional. When you do that, I mean, I have a feeling of devotion or surrender when I ask that.
There are different paths to the summit of the mountain. They always are the same summit. There are many paths that go to the top of the mountain, but they all get to the top. Mm-hmm. So you can use any path that appeals to you.
Robert, why is this teaching, which is essentially Eastern mysticism, as I understand it, why is it dying after Radiation?
Well, this
certainly appears to be.
Truth never dies out. I don't know what you mean by dying out.
Well, you look at countries like India, Japan, where Buddhism and Hinduism had very strong holds. And now you see that these teachings are practiced by, from what I understand, by very few, by fewer and fewer people all the time. I mean, they say that tremendous growth in Bombay. The land in Bombay costs more than New York. The Indians are good businessmen, and it's all becoming extremely westernized.
It's the way of the world. It goes up and goes down and goes up and goes down. It's been like that since the beginning of time. But you're looking at the world. Look to yourself. Don't worry about the world. The world has been destroyed numerous times and rebuilt again. We've had many civilizations on this earth.
We don't know about
throughout the billions of years of existence. We can't think about those things because they're past our mind. We have to know who we are, then we'll know everything else. So we shouldn't concern ourselves with history too much or get involved in the world situation too much because it can pull you into it. But rather we should work on ourselves. And then it's going to take care of itself.
Though things change, though as your consciousness is raised, do you become less interested in certain things?
Well, naturally, just like when you were a little girl,
yeah.
You drop stuff and now you're interested in other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, am I becoming antisocial? Or do I, or I've done, like, you know, you're invited to a wedding and I look at it and I'm going, okay, so I go to the wedding and I get home,
and
that's over.
You become selective. There's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah. It's like, well, I don't want them to think I don't care about why I went to their sister's wedding. Now I'm going to go to their wedding. You know, but it didn't matter to me that I went to the wedding. You know, it just, I didn't have a whole lot of interest in it.
But are you happy?
When I was there, I was there. When I went to the wedding, I was mindful. I was at the wedding. I didn't sit there and go, oh, I can't wait to get home. I mean, I wasn't complaining or anything. But I could have been just as happy being at home, and I went more out of probably somewhat obligation or, you know, family's going to be there. You know, I ought to be there. Then there's the persona that comes in because I might miss out on something. You know, that sort of thing.
That's it. There's nothing wrong with that. That's good.
But you might miss out on something.
Maybe you miss out on your doctor's time.
No, it doesn't matter.
I go to a lot of functions, but it's sort of wherever I am is fine.
But you're selective about it. I mean, you don't have obligation.
I'm not normally selective about anything. Everything just happens.
But you don't accept everything.
See, I'm not worried. I don't think about all these things. Whether I'm selective or not selective, whether I'm this or that. I just am. Whatever happens, happens.
So you're the same wherever you are.
Wherever I go.
But what if I called you at 2 o'clock this Sunday afternoon and said, there's a good movie, Robert, I'd like to go. It's going to last 4 hours, and we all assemble here. So then you are selected.
Why?
You made it a point to be here.
I made a point to be here?
Yeah.
And you mean I can't come because you went to the movie?
No, but I'm saying that if that option had come up,
you would have
had to say no. Apparently you do say no to other things.
Oh, of course.
Because you're here every Sunday.
But it's not being selective.
It is.
It's just a way of life.
You can't be in 2 places at once.
It's a way of life. I don't think about it, I just do it.
You don't have to be selective or not selective. It doesn't matter. You can be selective or not selective. It has to be a you to be selective. Yeah, so you don't have to say, I'm not selective.
I know it's difficult to understand. But I don't make a decision, I just do what has to be done. And there's no thought, there's no thought process. If somebody says, you want to go to the movie, I say, no, I'm going to a meeting. And I forget about it.
That's very difficult.
Oh, in other words, right. So there's no long-winded indecision?
There's no energy.
I'm trying to decide, should I go to the wedding? I don't really care if I go to the wedding, should I not go to the wedding?
And you go back and forth.
So if you fill the mind.
If you don't try to decide at all, you'll make the right decision.
For you, she's a good example of the importance of being selective. I mean, it really takes a lot of process of selection and determination to be here in the first place. Or you couldn't be here. You have too many.
I had to do that a bit today, yeah.
You would have to do it every day to go through what you go through.
If you're here 6 months from now, you won't have to tell them.
Okay, fine. Because Bob said today, I don't know, because the body was hankering at me, you know, and I said, well, why don't you take a shower? That zips you up sometimes, so okay, I'll go try that. I just kept on going. I just didn't try not to think about anything.
But you
took
the
shower, ate, got in the car, and I got here. But I don't like that going back and forth.
That's what you have to do now. Then it'll change.
Yeah. The simple analogy is when you said about you need the fan and you don't need the fan. Well, also when you're turning the fan off and trying not to beat the body, you're also going on one side of the pole as well. So, the fan could be on or it could be off. And it shouldn't matter. Or, you know, because you're also making a conscious process not to be your body by choosing one particular pull, either a lack of something or having something or not having something.
Theoretically, that makes sense, but that's why I brought up the term austerity. But when you give solace and joy and comfort to the body, you encourage the body to want more. So you are feeding.
Well,
you are feeding
the same pull because.
Are you saying then that if
it's the same as austerity?
It's not the same.
Yeah.
If we sat here without the fan and we were sweating, our bodies would not desire to sweat more and to have more heat.
We do desire
to have more, to be cooler and more and feel more pleasant.
But you can also turn it the other way and say, by feeling more pleasant, I have to pay more attention not to feel pleasant.
I know.
The body does not work that way.
I know. Yeah.
And that was the entire reason. Yeah. For austerities all over the world, whether in Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism, because of those reasons.
Yeah,
because the fan is encouraging the body. It is encouraging all of us to want pleasure and more joy for the body.
But that's like saying that it's better to be a monk. It's quicker to reach a spiritual plane by being a monk than being in labor, let's say, in the situation. But on the other side, by being in the world with all those things around you, you can also it's the same pole, but it's opposite.
Theoretically, and perhaps it's true for some, but the other point is a very important one to consider.
Even in austerity, who is austere?
Yeah.
It's still the self. It's the self that's creating all of these. It's still the ego. So it's the ego that runs after things, it's the ego that runs away from things, but it's still the ego, so there's no difference.
It isn't, but to some extent, while you're in the body, attention must be paid to these things. It is a razor's edge, it's true, it's the famous phrase, it's all a razor's edge, well, constantly, but because we are here in the three-dimensional world, to just constantly fall back on that idea leads to problems, because we must maintain the physical body.
Who's to say you won't? If you're practicing spiritual sadhana, your body will take care of itself. You will take care of it.
Will you either turn it down and you won't think about it?
That's it.
I mean, you'll be aware of it, but you'll just walk over to sin. You're not going to go, oh, this is making me feel better. It's giving me comfort. You won't go through all those processes.
That's it.
The mind.
Exactly.
You're a very high person.
My father comes in the window. Yeah. Here, why did you see that window closed?
There's nothing wrong while being in this vehicle to enjoy. Is that what did you say that?
Yes.
So if you enjoy the sound, but then you're saying by enjoying it, we're feeding it. But see, that's us another concept of the mind.
Of course.
Well, I think the bottom line question would be, because Arnold brought up a good point, that throughout history there have been austerities. Are austerities necessary?
They're necessary as long as they're there. And when you wake up, they're gone.
So it would be more or less a matter of karma, whether you were austere or not.
Your body is karmic. It came to this earth for a certain purpose. And it's going to accomplish that purpose whether you like it or not. It has nothing to do with you.
So you can live an austere life, that would be your karma or not.
Exactly.
Affects realization.
If it was your karma, you would have been born in Cambodia or Vietnam.
How about Paris?
Paris?
Let's talk about Paris.
The French Riviera?
Right. That'll do a lot.
If that was your karma, Las Vegas?
To detach from the fan, you could say, if you're sitting there and you're going, well, this fan over here is totally giving my body comfort. This is just total duality. Then you could stop the mind at that point and observe these thoughts and say, to whom does this comfort come?
Yeah, and to whom do the thoughts about it come?
Mm-hmm. That's true, it's all the same.
Or from whence do these thoughts come?
Mm-hmm.
Either one, but that would work, huh?
Yes.
You pose both of those. From whence does this come, and to whom does this come?
Makes no difference.
And it doesn't make any difference. However, I found this week I was making a judgment, and so I'm going, well, to whom did this judgment come? Because I felt like I was making a judgment about someone. Of course, there's no one else out there, but I thought, from whence does this judgment come? Instead of to whom did this judgment come? That's like pointing the finger.
Whatever turns you on.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't matter. As long as the observation is there,
you see, the problem is theoretically, everybody's repeating this, and it makes very good sense. I understand it as a theoretic and as a teaching, but I asked you about 2 weeks ago, I said, it seems to me that the teaching is very dangerous. And you said, yes, it is. Your answer was, yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And now, to carry on what you were saying, let's take a little further beyond the fact. Let's say that we go to work tomorrow and it's boring, it's dull, and to who does this happen? It doesn't happen to anybody. The work is you start doing less and less on the work. All right, to make a long story short, one thing leads to another. The first thing you find yourself out of the street, you say, I'm low street.
Why are you doing less?
Because this happened on low street. It's not happening to anybody.
But why are you doing less?
So you're going on down and down and down.
But let's go to the first premise.
Yeah.
Why are you doing less and less?
Why is it what?
Why are you doing less and less work?
Yeah, why do you assume that you do less and less?
Because it's no fun. And who is it happening to? There's nobody sitting at the desk anyway.
No, it's not.
So what difference does it make?
Do you know that, though? Is that something that...
It's something I'm practicing, let's say.
No, that's something...
My self-inquiry tells me that there is nobody there.
But that's also your mind. That's not something you experience. Because when you're in that state, you're not thinking that.
Mm-hmm. And this word at this point.
That's like saying, I have the same consciousness as Robert, but we don't. So theoretically, that's true, but we don't experience that, so it's not a reality.
So then we must make choices. We must be selective.
Yes.
And we must realize that we are, that the fan is giving us pleasure, and it may lead to the desirable one.
Well, that's what I said before, Yanov. You've got to work on yourself. If you're in that job, if you work on yourself correctly, you'll do more and more work, not less and less.
You know, something came to my mind when you were talking about the fan. When I came in this room, my first thought was, oh, this is not being here. And the thing is, everybody in this room is sitting here, and is anybody thinking, oh, this is not being here, I gotta get out?
I am.
No. Well, I was going to say, you know, if a lot of you aren't thinking that, then in a way, it's like you're accepting something that, even like a, you know, not wanting to work, it's like all in your mind. You know? I mean, we don't even realize that it's stuck in here because we're just comfortable in it.
And we're so into what we're talking about.
Yeah, and at your job, if you have a job that you hate, if you're in the state of mind, it's like you forget that it's a job that you hate or whatever.
Most people hate their jobs and they're aware of it all the time. That's not true. You don't forget it.
Well, maybe your job will change when you work on yourself. Well, don't forget what Jesus said about seeking first the kingdom of heaven and all these things will be added to you. And I think that includes the productivity of your job.
And
it's
like Robert says, focus on the self and then see how you grow.
All of this leads back to the Western ideas that there is growth and evolution, and that although I grant you, as you say, only in our world, but that if we concentrate on those things, then, to some extent, then we're in a better state. If we accept the relative world and acknowledge it, really give it our attention and our energy, we're in a much better place to move on eventually to other realms.
I don't know if I agree with that.
But the relative world changes. It's never the same.
Right, so we must change with it. That's why flexibility is important.
But then you can change with it until you die. And you haven't gotten anywhere. The whole idea is to change yourself, not the world.
Which goes back again to the seeking first the kingdom of heaven. Robert often says, do self-inquiry and then see how the world... Instead of going, oh my God, why is the world such a mess? Why are we in Kuwait? Why, you know, yada yada. But if you concentrate more on self-inquiry, the world may look differently to you.
Well, if you accept,
it still seems very dangerous to me.
If you accept,
what did you mean by that? We need the Robert thing to teach me dangerous.
He did say that. Do you remember saying that?
Yes, it is. It's dangerous to new people because it gives them license to go out and do anything they want.
Like, oh well, you know, you're preordained, so
nothing matters.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work like that.
But also, it seems to me that it's dangerous in that it. In some way, it draws off energy and attention from the relative world. So that there isn't, and it's so hard to survive in the world. So that when that energy and attention is drained off a little bit, you are left in kind of a limbo, and you're not, it's much more difficult to find yourself.
Who's
and
making,
any moment something can happen, you can be pulled under.
Who's making that statement? Who's this one? That's how you feel about it. That's not like that at all.
I don't know, it reminds me, there's a very interesting book called Faces, I think it's A Glimpse of Nothingness by a Dutch writer who went to the Orient, who became Zen Buddhist. Anyway, before he left Amsterdam, he discusses his quest and his spiritual desires with his father. And his father says, yes, but be careful. I knew a man who grew up the same way you did. And one day, the embassy in Iran reported he was found in a ditch on a country road. And that's always stayed in my mind because, I mean, those things are always happening to work, or similar things.
But you're working in the relative world. All this is relative.
Yeah, in a way, you know, that's just his body that was found
in a ditch. Really, people that get involved in drugs and things like that end up in a ditch. Not people on a spiritual quest, there's a similar thing that happens in Hawaii, that some people get into trouble there because if they're going into jungles where they're growing all the dope, it's like they're looking for trouble.
And that isn't true. History is full of stories of people, just in just the Catholic tradition, for example, of nuns, monks, who, I mean, maybe a very large number of them, who go crazy, become psychotic. They go into the monasteries and nunneries because of their spiritual desires, and yet the practices drive them out of their minds.
So